Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 73 of the Assorted Calibers podcast. The second minute podcast is a little bit for everyone. I'm Weird Beard, and with me, as always, is my wonderful and big deal hostess, Aaron Paulette. How you doing, Aaron?
I'm doing all right. Wow, we had a lot of shenanigans and before the thing started, and my throat's a little bit from doing Weird Beard impressions, which I'm sure our patrons will love in an upcoming blooper reel.
Good times. It's remarkably similar to my Aaron impersonation at the end of the last show.
Well, yeah. I mean, I figure if you're just going to do it like that, then that's how I'm going to do it, too.
Fair is fair. And see, doesn't it work? It sounds just like me.
Yeah, I'm going to postulate that I sound more like you than you sound like me, but... So yeah, I don't really have anything much going on right now other than just getting ready to go be super popular and talking about stuff over the weekend, which I talked about last week. No need to rehash that.
Just Aaron is a colossal deal, folks.
Did you just call me fat?
I'd like to speak to my lawyer. Am I being detained?
So how are you doing?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing all right. I am tired. We took the little girl to the fair, and let me tell you, that wore her straight out. And well, let me tell you, when little girl gets tired, little girl gets ugly.
So is this like the county fair?
You know, I don't know. It's the Topsfield Fair in Topsfield, Massachusetts. I don't know if it's a state fair or a county fair. It's just a great big livestock fair. And yeah, we eat gross fried food and look at cows and touch chickens. It was a good time.
Did you carry?
I absolutely did. Yeah. They got a weird security check thing where you unzip your backpack, and it was actually hilarious. I unzipped the backpack I was carrying, and it was just a whole bunch of stuffed animals were looking back up at the security guard, and he just unzipped it back up.
Yeah, but they didn't like wand you or nope. Make you go through a metal detector.
Nope, they never do. Had the old 1911 in the shoulder holster.
Were they posted or not? And do postings have force of law in Massachusetts?
Postings do not have force of law in Massachusetts. That's just the standard issue. You know, if they discover that you are, they can ask you to leave. There's certainly no postings on the outside. There might be a rule somewhere, someplace that says it's not allowed because lawyers, but whatevs. You never know when a bad guy's going to do bad things in a fair or a terrorist attack or a rogue bull.
Rogue bull.
That's right. In which case, I want some steaks, and maybe my wife has a rule against, I am allowed to go hunting, but I am not allowed to bring home trophies from the hunt. I think if I shot a bull at the fair, I think that definitely needs to go on the wall right above my computer here.
Well, now, I mean, meat doesn't count as trophies, does it?
No.
Okay.
No. You don't eat trophies, Aaron. Well, I don't.
I just wanted to make sure that your wife wasn't saying you can't bring anything back from the hunt.
No, no. You just go out and shoot as many deer as you want and leave them in the field to rot. Thanks, honey. That sounds like a great plan. Or just whatever you can eat right there.
Look, man, I don't know. You married her, not me. And the fact that she's already married you proves she has questionable judgment to begin with. So I don't know. So speaking of poor taste and bad judgment, one of the things we're going to talk about tonight is the anti-gun rally in Michigan that was held in a gun club of all places. What's up with that?
Oh, Haley Stevens. She's from the U.S. Congress, and she held a gun control town hall meeting at, let's see if I've got the name of the club, but it was at a Rod and Gun Club in Michigan.
But there's so much more to the story than that.
Yeah. Well, so what happened was they had this anti-gun meeting at a gun club.
Well, no. You're actually, I think, burying part of the story.
Okay.
It's that when they made the reservation for the rally at the gun club, they didn't specify it was going to be anti-gun.
Yeah, and actually they even did it through like a shell group. Like it was not the pack that was paying for it actually ran under an alternate incorporated name.
Right.
So it was done all on the sly.
And so you have members of a gun club who obviously own guns and like guns and believe in the Second Amendment are showing up to a rally where not only is someone railing against what they believe, but this woman was, well, I think it was her, but she's practically screaming at them about how the NRA is awful. And, you know, I've found that when I'm trying to convince someone who has opposing beliefs, that screaming at them at the top of my lungs is really, really effective in bringing them along to my point of view. Don't you agree, Weird?
Oh, yeah. No, I thought you were full of crap, but then you raised your voice and your eyes got all bloodshot. And then suddenly I was like, man, she's serious. She must be right. Yeah, no, I wasn't bearing the lead because, so I was just going on the 25,000 foot view is these anti-gun people come to a gun club to hold a rally, and then essentially the pro-gun people that are members of this club or from the area all show up and essentially just shout them out of the room. Like they end up like packing up and leaving early. And just vacating the field to the 2A supporters, and of course the person who posted this in the Facebook group was like, yeah, what do they expect holding an anti-gun rally in a gun club? But I think it goes bigger than this. I think this is so. I talk about it in my weird audio fisks all the time. Is they had that Rasmussen poll that came out after Sandy Hook that said like 90 billion percent of Americans and most NRA members want more background checks and stricter gun control laws. And they talk about this all the time. And I think there's been like some other follow-up ones that say the same thing, that say, oh, geez, like gun control, super duper duper popular. And yet, of course, it's not true. Because if it wasn't true, then when they do put these referendum questions through, it would skirt by with such narrow margins. And when, you know, the Congress people get a hold of this, they're like, yeah, no, we're leaving it alone. And, oh, but the NRA gives money. Yeah, Bloomberg gives a lot more money. So it's not money. And it's really just their constituents are like, no, we don't want it. And so I think this is part of that, is they always are parroting these polls that aren't true. They might have been good polls or they might have been bad polls. I have no idea. Not important. They don't represent reality. I think the purpose was that they wanted to rent a gun club, pack it with their members, and then have it essentially be like Beto O'Rourke, where he went to a gun show, and oddly enough, the only people he talked to were people who wanted to ban all the guns. It is creating a false reality. It is creating an image that is convenient to them, but goes against what the average person might believe and what is true.
Well, someone messed up somewhere, because that's not what happened.
It was a corresponding congresswoman got wind of it, and she sent the balloon up, because it was none of the gun owners even knew, like none of the club members even knew this was going on. Like this was not something that was announced to the club or anything like that. This was just, it was rented, and they did not ask for it to be publicized, which I've got to assume that probably most gun clubs, yeah, if you want to rent out the function hall or rent out the range or all that, yeah, we'll take your money. We're not going to go too deep into why you're doing it, so long as you're not going to make the club look horrible. And so,
this was basically trying to do.
Yeah, but they also took efforts to conceal themselves on what they were doing and who they were. So,
well, yeah, I mean, I agree with you on that. I was just saying there might be something contractual involved. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm saying that the club might have some sort of legal recourse. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. It depends. It all depends on how well they wrote stuff up and how concerned about such things they were. I will say that if their contracts don't have such wording in them, they do now.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so these people got driven off, and it was all because of counterintelligence. And so, yeah, because they were doing everything they could to make themselves hidden in doing this, probably so they could make it appear. Be actually kind of interested to see if it went over correctly, to see what stereotypes they would have on the, hey, wear your combat boots, wear camouflage, wear some red MAGA hats, and then talk about how much you love gun control. I don't know, but just the, yes, Senor O'Rourke, I too like the gun control. I am so glad you are running for president. So yeah, I think this was supposed to be a ruse. It was supposed to be a theatrical thing to try to make people think. I think their plan is, I don't know if it's going to work. I hope it doesn't, just because, I mean, it's just a bad plan, but I think their plan is, by them painting people who actually support the Second Amendment and be like, yeah, I own AR-15s. It's a really versatile rifle. It's a wonderful gun to own. Why wouldn't you own an AR-15? They want to paint those people as extremists. Those are the, you know, crazy militias out in the woods overthrowing the government, and get people that are the, well, geez, I know Joe up the street. He's got an AR-15. He doesn't seem like he's all that wrong. Oh, maybe he is one of those secret overthrowing the government racist people. I hope it doesn't work, because, again, it's just horrible. But that appears to be what they're trying to do. So in other news, speaking of people running for president, I mentioned old Robert Francis. I've got to say this as unfortunate. I was thinking about how I was going to talk about this on the show, and I kind of realized this guy's almost kind of sort of the ACP endorsed candidate for president. Not my specific endorsed candidate, not any of the necessarily members, but on the idea that this is a political podcast that is nonpartisan. So long as you are good on guns, that's fine. And so I'm upset with Donald Trump on his stance on guns. We got all the vast majority of the Democrats have either come from anti-gun states that just do horrible things to gun owners, or have just been straight up said, oh yeah, no, we're going to do some horrible draconian restrictions if I become president.
Constitution? What constitution?
Exactly. To Bernie Sanders, who has been saying some anti-gun stuff, because I think he thinks it's important to show up in the Democrat base. But overall, he's got a really good record on guns in Vermont. And overall, I think he's kind of like Donald Trump. Donald Trump really doesn't care about guns. And so if gun control slides across his desk, yeah, he might sign it, or he might do a crappy executive order. He might pressure the ATF to do some stupid stuff. Bernie Sanders, at the same time, he's not going to lose any sleep trying to pass gun control laws, because he lives in Vermont and knows that everybody has guns there, and people aren't shooting each other there, because that's how it works. If you're not doing other horrible things that would get you interested in shooting people, yeah, no, the gun doesn't have mind control rays. But as I say, Bernie Sanders, unfortunately, has, at first they said he was hospitalized for angina, but no, he was hospitalized. He had a full on heart attack, and he is now going to take several weeks to recoup from this, which I would predict is going to just completely torpedo his political aspirations, at least for president, because he's been really beating the bushes. I mean, he's 73 years old. He's not a spring chicken, but boy, he makes a whole lot of appearances and goes to a whole lot of places and holds rallies and speeches and all that. And that is going to have to come to a stop if he wants to hold on to what health he's got left. And so, yeah, I think he's out. And judging by, there's all this talk on impeachment, whether it's true or not, the impeachment is about investigating criminal activities that Joe Biden probably did in the Ukraine to get his junkie son installed in various executive positions that he had no right in being in. And all the other candidates polling at like 5% or lower might mean that old Liz Warren's going to get in, which, as a resident of Massachusetts and someone who actually turned around and broke my vow to never vote for Scott Brown ever again after he broke all his campaign promises, and going, wow, Liz Warren, she's pretty horrible. maybe I'll vote for Scott Brown instead of her. So I think she's going to be the nominee.
So just to set the record straight, Bernie Sanders is 78 years old.
Wow. Oh, man, I gave him a little generous term. That is an advanced age to be pursuing the presidency, which, mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the big things that like a bunch of people are talking about is why are these people so old? I mean, Donald Trump is, if he gets elected for a second term, he mm-hmm. is going to be just by a few months, the second oldest man to ever hold the office of presidency. Ronald Reagan was a few months older than him when he started his second term. And so there's that. And then you've got someone who's Bernie Sanders, who's older than Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. And Biden's not very young, is not a young man. And
Biden is 76.
Yeah. And Liz Warren, I think, just turned 70, I think.
I don't know about just turned, but yeah, she's 70. And for sake of completeness, Donald Trump is 73.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah. So a lot of old people, a lot of old whiteys. So diversity. So long as you like old whiteys. All right, it's a nonpartisan podcast. Let's let us step slowly away. I wish Bernie Sanders the best. I have differs with him on his political opinions personally, but as far as his stance on guns goes, his record's pretty good. So he gets my thumbs up on that, and I hope he. I mean, I don't think his presidential campaign's gonna go so well, but hopefully he lives a long and healthy political career.
So speaking of presidential candidates, did you hear about what happened with Kamala Harris and the domestic violence survivor that wanted to talk to her about ERPOs?
Oh, I heard about that just briefly. I did not like see the video or anything like that.
So here's the thing. I actually met this lady at GRPC. Her name is Carrie Sloan. She's the founder of We the Female, which is, and I'm going to probably be doing a horrible disservice to her and her organization, but We the Female is basically the female version of Operation Blazing Sword, in that the purpose of the organization is to reach out to women and teach them self-defense. And Ms. Sloan is a domestic violence survivor. And so she was up in D.C. recently, and she got a chance to speak to Harris. It wasn't like a sit-down appointment, but she said something like, "Ms. Harris, I am a domestic violence survivor. I'd like to talk to you about ERPOs." ERPOs are the...
Extreme Risk Protection Orders.
Thank you. Extreme Risk Protection Orders. And as the story goes, Harris nodded her head at that. And then Ms. Sloan said, "Okay, great, let's have that conversation." And then two staffers from Harris's office moved in between them and prevented her from talking until Harris got away. And so this was more than just a snub. This was we will do everything up to, they didn't touch her, so it wasn't exactly physical restraint, but it was, yeah, we're going to block you. And so that looks bad, and she's been spreading the word, and so I'm helping spread the word.
Is there any video of this?
Yeah, there is video, and it's on a town hall page, and there is a link to that in the show notes. You can see it as it happens.
Oh, man, look at that. Like, she is literally treating this town hall like the anti-gun groups treat the comment section on YouTube. Just comments are not allowed for this video. Well, shifting gears, you might have heard about them, but have you ever used one? And if you've used one, are you using it right? All right, get your mind out of the gutter. I'm talking about Oddball. I mean, I'm not talking about using Oddball. I'm talking about Oddball talking about camping hammocks. Let's just play it.
Welcome to Oddball's Corner Pocket. Recently, I went to an event called Outside Con, which I tend to refer to as Geeks Go Camping. While Panya likes to sleep in a tent, I've found that I prefer sleeping in a hammock that weekend. I know that Aaron has asked me about it in the past, so I thought I'd talk about it now. Over the past couple years, hammock camping has become fairly popular. They've gone from being a specialty item that only a handful of companies made, and you had to either order them or buy them at a specialty shop, to being made by a huge number of companies and carried by the likes of Academy and Walmart. This has made them both more accessible to people and less expensive. First off, if you're not familiar with them, these are probably not what you imagine when you think of hammocks. Most of us grew up with hammocks being made of rope or canvas with a spreader bar on both ends. While these are great for your backyard, those spreader bars aren't great for throwing in your backpack and hiking through the woods. Camping hammocks are typically made out of a thin parachute material and simply have their ends bunched up and tied together in a knot, foregoing the spreader bars entirely. These are sometimes referred to as Brazilian-style hammocks. There are two mistakes that people tend to make when they first try this style hammock. The first is that they hang their hammocks too tight. Besides putting undue stress on the hammock, it makes it unstable. This style of hammock should sag down and make a pocket. If you've hung the hammock correctly, it is practically impossible to fall out once you're in. If it's too tight, it can be easy to get off balance, flip the hammock, and fall out. And, well, that's just an embarrassing way to wake up. The recommended angle for the support ties seem to be somewhere between 30 and 50 degrees. The second mistake people make is trying to lie parallel with the hammock. As weird as this sounds, it's better to lay diagonally. This does a couple things. It allows you to be further down into that pocket I mentioned earlier, and therefore more stable. It also allows you to lay more flat. While laying in a hammock can be very comfortable, it can be downright painful if you're laying in it wrong. The sag will cause a curve that needs to be accounted for. If you're lying parallel with the hammock, this curve can cause strain on your knees as they essentially try to hyperextend. As you can imagine, over not much time, this can be quite painful. If, on the other hand, you're lying at a diagonal, you will lay more flat and this will not be an issue. Some folks throw a pillow under their knees to further assist with this. As much as it would be fun to say all you need is a hammock and some straps, there are a few other things that you'll want if you're planning on actually sleeping in one in the woods. The most obvious is a rain fly. Even if it's not going to rain, chances are that you're under some trees, and you don't want to wake up because a drop of dew fell in, say, your ear canal. Trust me on this one. You can obviously just use a tarp and some paracord for this, but they do make flies specifically designed for the task, which are of lighter weight material, come with string that you need, and pack up into a small package. Next, if you're like me and live where there are biting bugs, you'll want a bug net. You can either get a hammock that has a bug net attached to it, or a net that fully encloses the hammock. The bug nets that are attached are probably the better choice, but I've used both without any issue. The attached ones are a little bit easier to get in and out of, and makes for a smaller package. Lastly, I would highly recommend getting an underquilt. This is another one of those things that folks won't think about until they've tried it. Most blankets, sleeping bags, etc., lose their insulative qualities when compressed by, for example, someone laying on it. Believe it or not, this, coupled with the fact that most of these hammocks are made of a thin nylon material, means that your rear end can get pretty chilly if the temperature drops much below even 70 degrees. This can be dealt with by sleeping on a camping mat in the hammock, but it's very obvious when you slip off of it. This can be an issue if you've got broad shoulders like me. I've tried this method, and it worked, but it took some doing to make sure I was properly laying on the mat, and I did wake up a few times where I'd fallen off of it. The other option is an underquilt. The best way to describe this is that it's like a camping blanket that hangs just under the hammock. Since it's under the hammock, it doesn't get compressed. A lightweight underquilt below me, plus a blanket on top of me, and I've slept quite happily while it was in the 50s. Like I mentioned earlier, Erin had asked me about hammock camping in the past. In particular, she was interested in it from a budget perspective. Unfortunately, even though the prices have come down considerably over the years, I'm not sure it's a good budget option compared to using a tent. While there are kits that include the hammock, straps, bug net, and rainfly starting at $40 to $50 on Amazon, that underquilt starts at about $70. While that's a lot cheaper when I started, where a hammock by itself started at $100 and an underquilt was going to cost you at least $200, it's still more than what you can get a cheap tent and sleeping bag at Walmart for. I'm also not convinced that it's the best for the folks that like to have the lightest packs possible for hiking and camping. These folks tend to just go with a rainfly and a bedroll. While going with a hammock is not adding a whole lot, it's obviously adding some to that. Even with the ultralight single-person tents, the weight is really about the same. The big thing I see as a benefit is comfort. Honestly, sleeping in a properly set up hammock is like sleeping in a zero-gravity chair. Even on an air mattress, I've never slept as well in a tent than I have in a hammock. Heck, I've not slept as well in some hotel rooms than in that hammock. There's also the fact that you really don't have to care about what the ground is like. I've spent a lot of time looking for ground that was flat enough so I didn't roll down the hill in my tent, and I've also spent a lot of time trying to find ground that wasn't covered in rocks or tree roots or what have you. Neither of these are really an issue with a hammock because, well, you are hanging above the ground. Of course, I forgot to mention that you will want to remember to take your shoes off before getting in the hammock, and if you have anything in your pockets like keys, you might want to take those out too, or risk poking a hole in that hammock. If any of this sounds good to you, I suggest you go ahead and try it, even if it is just your backyard and you're just hooking it up for the day. Most people's gear is piecemeal, so feel free to buy your equipment a little at a time. Anyways, if you would like to read more of my thoughts, I write at gunscarstech.com. If you have any questions, feel free to contact me at oddball@gunscarstech.com or leave a message on the ACP Facebook page. Until next time, have a good one.
It's funny and kind of cute the way, you know, you're making it dirty while not trying to, and here I'm going, well, you know, hammock is another, it's like a slang term for a man's G-string.
Ooh.
You know, banana hammock, posing pouch.
Yep.
You're never not going to be able to think of that now.
No, that's, I mean, it's, I already thought about banana hammock all the time whenever I'm in an actual hammock. I've never actually slept in any hammock. I have just done the backyard relaxing type hammock. And the closest I ever got to sleeping in a hammock was I was on a boat and there all the bunks were taken up. And so literally I was sleeping on the bench of the table and it was not comfortable. And then I looked in one of the back rooms and someone had strung up a hammock. And I said, oh, that's a good idea. So I climbed into the hammock and I said, oh, yeah, nice. It'll swing with the boat. So it might probably feel a little bit more stable. No, it magnifies the wave action. I laid in it for about 5 minutes and then got out and immediately went outside and threw up over the side. I get so seasick.
The only experience I've had with hammocks was back in the 90s, I think. I got one of those. Oh, the Bud K catalogs. You know what I mean. And I saved up my money and I bought one of those. I don't think they built it as a tactical hammock, but you know, it's olive drab. It's nylon. It's super tough. You take it camping. It folds up into the size of a fist. Rah. And okay, so it's cool, and it's just it's nothing but green nylon webbing, and it all goes to a ring, and then on the other end of the ring is rope. And I had exactly the problems that Oddball mentioned, because I just thought you got in the hammock parallel to it. And yeah, I basically formed a very lazy sort of V, and that was not comfortable, just kind of jackknifed there.
Yep.
In the hammock, and I couldn't figure out how anyone could sleep in it, because no, it didn't come with instructions on how to use it. I didn't know you're supposed to get diagonal. Would have been nice to know.
Yep. I've also heard another thing about it is that hammocks can actually be warmer than sleeping on a tent, in the theory that you're essentially kind of in a giant thermos sort of idea. You're air insulated when you're hanging there, versus when you're in a tent laying on the ground, you're essentially laying on a giant heat sink that is the earth.
Yeah, that's true, because the earth does conduct heat away from you faster than the air does. There's a lot to be said about hammocks, especially the ones that have the integrated rainfly and bug netting and all that other stuff. The problem that I have with them is that if you don't have any trees, you're kind of screwed.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to have one of those, like, in a bug-out bag. And Florida has trees. In fact, we frequently have a lot of trees, but they aren't everywhere. And, well, you know, a tent, I can put up nearly anywhere. A hammock, you gotta have something to tie it off to. So I really, really want to like camping hammocks, but the price, and well, there's also the fact that there's like no security for your gear, at least with a tent. You know, I can like bring my bag in with me. So I appreciate him doing this segment. That's lots of good information. They aren't yet for me, but maybe someday. Who knows?
Yeah. Also, the whole in New England, we got lots of trees. Like you'll be walking through deep, dark, dense woods, and you will come across the stone wall, and you'd be like, "Oh, this was the edge of some farmer's field, and now it's a forest." So yeah, the I spend a lot of time picking maple trees out of my flower gardens.
Yeah, that's how you smoke some of your meat, right?
That's correct. That's correct. Yeah, there's was just that's maple wood that's fallen around the yard. Yeah, I just save it.
So weird. You make a big deal about me being a big deal, and I appreciate it. I think sometimes you go a little far,
or not far enough.
Possibly, but I'm not the only big deal on this podcast. Because, as it turns out, someone contacted you for an interview, and they knew who you were, and they knew about the podcast, and they read your blog. And that's kind of a big deal, especially when the person doing the contacting is as notable as our next guest.
Yes, I got a chance to sit down and talk with Dr. Miguel Faria. And I had not heard his name beforehand, but let me tell you, I was well aware of his work after I realized who I was talking to.
Now, I do want to sort of caution, that's the wrong word, but I can't think of a better one. I want to caution our listeners. Dr. Faria has a very thick Cuban accent, so you're going to need to actively listen to understand him in some instances. So if you're listening to this in the car and there's a lot of road noise, you're going to get frustrated. Get to a place where you can be quiet and listen, because what he says is really fascinating, because this is the man who helped debunk the Kellerman study, right?
Correct.
Yeah, and there was something else in there, and I don't remember what. But you know what? I'm not going to give it away. We're just going to listen. And another, I guess, word of warning. This is a very long interview. It was going to be in two parts, but because next week is going to be a round table, I convinced Weird that he should do it just in one cut, so it's not like broken apart by several weeks. So sit down, get comfortable. This is a really good interview. It will be worth your time.
I am pleased to bring to the show Dr. Miguel Faria. Now, he has written a book called America, Guns, and Freedom. How you doing, Dr. Faria?
I'm doing very well, and happy to be here, and thank you for inviting me to your show.
Well, I mean, it's great to have you on. So, first up, can you tell us about this book that you've written?
This book is a compilation of many things. It really began as a personal story, because in 1990, I was involved in the Medical Association of Georgia, and actually became the editor of the state medical journal. And at that point, I realized that there was something wrong with what we consider gun and violence and domestic violence. We were getting information from the AMA telling us that domestic violence was a problem, but then the papers that were sent to us for publication were all about gun control. And when I'm a neurosurgeon, so here I am seeing all these papers that are supposed to have scientific knowledge and were based on scientific research. And instead, what I found was propaganda, gun control propaganda, disseminated through the medical journals, research that was pseudoscientific. It was politicized. It had preordained results. In other words, if you didn't conclude that guns were bad and that needed to be removed from the general population, this article should not be published. They have to have that conclusion. The second conclusion was interesting, and that is always they will ask for more research is needed, which was a self-interest, a vested self-interest, because here are the researchers not only pushing for gun control propaganda, but they were asking for more money, taxpayers' money, to conduct more and more research. So I saw there was a conflict of interest as well. So I was very disturbed because I was supposed to continue this. And I said, no, I'm the editor now. And I think that if we're going to discuss gun violence, then we need to have articles on both sides of the debate. And I had papers sent to me, for example, from Dr. Edgar Souter, that were much better written than anybody had ever sent to the State Medical Journal. And these articles had a criminologic and sociologic point of view that was distinct from what we were reading in public health literature. And Dr. Souter, in fact, compiled the beneficial aspects of gun ownership, the constitutional issues, and then he went on to debunk many of the so-called scientific studies promulgating gun control and showing all the errors in methodology, truncated data, non-sequitur logic, and overt mendacity in some cases. And yet, his studies have been not accepted, have been rejected by other medical journals. And I went ahead and they passed our review and I published them. So when this happened, oh boy, it was a tremendous clamor. Even though I was attacked by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is our main newspaper in Georgia, by name. And it began an incredible controversy. So 3 years later, I had to resign from being editor, only because I wanted to show both sides of the gun control debate and show, always asking, where is the science? If the science is missing, then I don't care what the conclusions were. Those papers would not be published. And, of course, that would contravene the policy of the State Medical Journal and the AMA and the public health establishment. So I became a thorn on their back and was forced to resign. Interestingly enough, no sooner did I have resigned that I was asked to testify at a congressional committee this was in the spring of 1996, to testify about the scientific merits of all these papers that were coming out from the CDC, papers that were funded by public money, by taxpayers. And I was asked, along with three other experts, Dr. William Waters, Dr. Timothy Wheeler, and criminologist Don B. Cates. And the committee was so impressed with our testimony that the following summer, the summer of 1996, Congress passed the Dickey Amendment, which forbid the CDC from using taxpayer money to promulgate gun control. Now, that holds up to this day. The media has said, oh, why, this is terrible. Here comes the CDC being told that they cannot do scientific research on guns. And they have disseminated this canard. In reality, what the Congress say is that they did not want junk science and gun control propaganda. They did not ban scientific research. The second thing that was happened was that the CDC lost at the time $2.5 million in taxpayers' money for this kind of research. The third thing that happened was that the number one investigator for the CDC, Dr. Arthur Kellerman, was removed from the roles of experts. In other words, he lost the money he was getting to conduct his research because of the testimony showing that his research was not scientific and that was purely gun control propaganda. Of course, we went into details, and if we have time, we can discuss two of the issues that Dr. Kellerman has promulgated that to this day is being used for gun control because of those two points that Dr. Kellerman has made. One of them, for example, is that if there is a gun in the house, it is more likely to result in the death or injury to the person in the home than it is to hurt an assailant. In 1986, in the New England Journal of Medicine, he claimed that it was 43 times more likely to result in the death of a family member than an intruder. We criticize, when I say we, several experts. I have not entered the discussion at that point. I didn't enter the discussion until about 1991. But he was criticized, for example, by Dr. Kay and by Dr. Professor Gary Clegg and others because of the errors he made. So that in 1993, he came back and said, no, it's not 43 times. It's only 2.7 times more likely to injure a family member than an intruder. And yet, that number was also fallacious. Fallacy number one and fallacy number two. Again, why did we believe that the studies were wrong? Well, the population selected was dysfunctional to begin with. There was significant domestic violence in the family members he chose. We never really could find out where the guns came in from. For example, the criminal himself may have brought the gun in, and the gun was not in the house to begin with. All of this, he completely neglected the previous criticisms, and he continued to make the same mistakes, the same errors in 1993 paper. And it's something that public health officials tend to do. You criticize them for what they have done, and they continue to make the same errors. They have so much power because the medical journals are willing to publish their papers, even with all that, with the errors that they have. Because as long as they conclude that gun availability, or as they say, easy gun availability, results in crime, both homicide and suicide, the guns were bad, and they were responsible for this. That's the first conclusion. The second conclusion is that more studies are needed. What does that mean? We want more money. So as long as you have those two conclusions, they were published. And Dr. Kellerman, really, this conclusions are still used today, even though they have been debunked extensively by some of the people that I mentioned and myself in the medical and the criminologic literature, especially by Professor Gary Clegg. And yet the media ignores our criticism and continue to say that if you have a gun in the house, you're more likely to hurt yourself or a family member than you are to defend your home from an assailant. And this is used for gun control, and in fact, it's used today by the medical establishment to empower doctors to ask patients if they have a gun in the house. In fact, that has become a standard question now of doctors, especially pediatricians and psychiatrists, who should know better than to ask their patients if they have a gun, where do you keep it? Do you know that it's more likely for you to get hurt than it is that you're able to protect your family? You should not have a gun in the house, which is, of course, propaganda, and it's an abuse of the patient-doctor relationship. Because when a patient comes to see you, they are in somewhat a subservient position because they are vulnerable. They are at their health is held by in the patient's hand, so in the doctor's hand, and they are vulnerable to such kind of propaganda. And we denounce this. Well, it's been used because of that study from 1986 and 1993, which have been thoroughly debunked in the criminologic, the sociologic, and in the medical literature because of my work as an editor of the Journal of the Medical Association of Georgia. And I continue to work as a medical editor. I founded another journal for another medical society, and I'm right now the associate editor for an international journal of neurosurgeons, Surgical Neurology International. So they cannot silence me. And we continue to debunk some of these articles, but yet the media ignores us, Hollywood ignores us, and I had to write the book to set the record straight. And I hope, you know, as you have seen, it's 460 pages and have 60 pages of notes so that I document every statement that I made. I'm very proud of this book.
Yeah, no, I that was one thing that I went through. Like I said, I hadn't had a chance to read the whole thing just yet because it's a substantial book. It's so far it's very good. My wife's also picked it up and she loves it as well. I highly recommend it to everybody, and there'll be a link to it in the show notes. But yeah, I went and looked at your footnotes because I mean this podcast has footnotes because we don't just say something, we say something and back up why we say it. You talked about how all of these journals were pushing for studies that released more gun control, and these are peer-reviewed journals, and in many cases, highly respected journals. And I wanted to ask you, since you've definitely got more insight in it than I do, how does it happen that a heavily respected scientific journal can get to the point of pushing pseudoscience like this?
Well, it's interesting, very interesting, and I actually have a picture. My book is highly illustrated, as you have seen, and I have a picture of Jerome Kassirer, who was the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, which can be called the flagship of the medical journals. And he had a debate on CBS with Dr. Timothy Wheeler, a friend of mine. He's the founder of Doctors for Responsible Gun Ownership. And it was an amazing debate. But Dr. Kassirer, the highly respected editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, had made statements to the fact that no data are needed for studying assault weapons because they were bad, they caused death, and therefore no data is needed to confirm this. That's one of the things. Another one, coming from the scientific committee of the AMA, they made the egregious statement, very erroneous, that you why not use watermelons to study head injuries with assault weapons? Can you imagine watermelons? And these are people that are supposed to be scientific. This, you can imagine now when the scientific committee of the AMA made such a statement, it's eventually saying to all the researchers, hey, forget about peer review. This articles have to be published. The peer review is sham, therefore. It's a sham operation. Anyway, if going from there, can you imagine? Let me bring this point in because this, again, this is Arthur Kellerman in 1992. He proposed that easy gun availability, and that's a phrase that we always remember, put that in quotes, results in more death, including suicide, and that suicide in the United States with the use of firearms was the number one in the world, that guns and were responsible for suicide, period. And went into all this data trying to prove this, ignoring the most important fact, and that is the substitution method that other countries use that are depend on cultural preferences. Well, what does this mean? Well, it doesn't matter how you kill yourself. The fact is that the United States is actually in the middle ground for suicide when compared to the rest of the world. But if you say suicide with guns, then we may be number one. But it doesn't matter whether you commit suicide using a samurai sword, like it happens in Japan, or jumping in front of a train. I mentioned those two because those are the two of the favorite methods in Japan. Jumping in front of trains have now become number one. And the Japanese commit suicide at two or three times the level of the United States, much higher rates of suicide. But by separating and only studying gun suicides, of course, they put the United States number one because that's the method that is used in the United States. It's a cultural method. In Germany, people hang themselves. In England, people will use poisonous gases. In Sri Lanka and most third world nations, people use pesticides. They drink pesticides. Oh, let's mention Hungary and Czechoslovakia. In those countries, people jump into the Danube and they drown. And in all of the countries that I mentioned, people commit suicide at a much higher rate than the United States. But you can see the mendacity, the fraudulent dishonesty of these studies in which they only use gun suicide, because that way the United States look bad in comparison to other countries. But like I say, it does not matter what the method is. It's the totality of the percentage of the death, the total number of suicides per country, that is what matters. They substitute guns for other methods that are culturally preferred by the people in different countries, and they do it at a much higher rate of suicide than the United States. See, this is another facet of the dishonesty, and yet these articles are passing peer review, and again, in the New England Journal of Medicine, that's where Dr. Kellerman published this article with Rivera in 1992, and it passed scrutiny. And yet, as soon as I reviewed the article, as soon as the Professor Clegg reviewed the article, as soon as criminologist Cates reviewed this article, and Dr. Edgar Suter and Dr. Timothy Wheeler, they found all these errors. How can it be that a scientific publication like the New England Journal of Medicine could make those errors, could make that mistake? Because we are dealing with political propaganda, ideological propaganda, and not the scientific method. And again, I stress this in my book as another area that I discuss in my book because it needs to be discussed. So here we are. What is peer review? in the proper hands, perhaps it can be used. I used it. We still use it at the Surgical Neurology International. And why cannot this other medical journals that have decided to go along with the flow and push for propaganda have subverted science for a political ideology? It's incredible. It's highly disturbing. And as long as I can speak out, I will do so.
Oh, and I so appreciate that you are speaking out, especially from your level of expertise. I mean, it's as a scientist, I am ashamed that this is going on. But at the same time, I've seen it happen in other fields, and it's not necessarily a sinister cabal. It's just a simple way of, hey, how can we get more grant money? We live on grant money. That's how we survive. So I'm glad that truth should always win out.
Well, it's hypocritical, too, because, you know, the public health establishment is very keen to criticize, for example, any private investigator in the pharmaceutical industry. It's a good example. If they find any connection between the researcher and the private industry, because he gets his salary, he has to, you know, get money from somewhere. Well, if he comes from the private sector, his studies are tainted. You know, because he receives money from such and such chemical company or pharmaceutical company, and they basically reject the findings of studies that are actually being very good. And yet, as I mentioned before, in the public health establishment, every study has the two conclusions. One, that easy gun availability results in more crime, more homicide, and more suicides, and that crime is propounded because so many people have guns, and that there is a gun epidemic that must be eradicated, basically. The second point is that more studies are needed. In other words, we want more money, and therefore, they don't see that is, to me, is a conflict of interest to always have the same conclusion, that more money is as study, more grants are necessary to study this and to study that. And they don't see a vested interest. I pointed that out. And another thing that I haven't mentioned, in addition to testifying in Congress in 1996, one other thing that happened was in 2002, I was called from the White House for me to accept a honorary position, but a working position, at the CDC to ascertain that studies on violence were scientific. So I was inducted, and I did this basically without payment to study grants asking for money for violence research. You can imagine. So in that committee, I became a Dr. No. Because I kept on pointing out the errors in methodology, errors in truncation of data, and so on and so forth. And I did this for 3 years at the CDC. So I was working in the belly of the beast. And that is, again, two short chapters in the book relate to this. I enjoy it, but it was difficult. Because, as you can imagine, I was the one that was usually was outvoted by the other members who wanted to continue I won't say all of them. There were a couple of honest people there working with me. But for the most part, there were other officials there or researchers that wanted to continue to pass to fund this and fund that and fund more and more studies, because when their time came to ask for money, they wanted to also be approved. See, it's a quid pro quo that happened almost without noticing it, but it's exactly what it is. And I try to point out that these studies were funded in exchange of you fund my study and I fund yours. In reality, that is what ended up being what ended up happening. And I was one of the few that when I felt that the study did not show the science that they should not be funded. It was an interesting thing that I did and that I'm very proud of.
Well, all of us who are fans of the Second Amendment and liberty in general appreciate what you have done and science in general. Yes, that is Dr. Miguel Faria, and that is America, Guns, and Freedom, and you can find a link to that in the show notes. Thank you so much for coming on the show, Doctor.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, so one thing that I didn't fully understand, there was something about a watermelon.
Yeah, I actually went and tried to look that up and wasn't sure. I think there were some groups that were talking about head injury. I mean, Dr. Faria is a neurosurgeon, so I think he might have crossed into some of the stuff that goes into that angle of people using watermelons as a fill-in for a human head as far as head injuries go. And there might have been people shooting watermelons to. I remember I actually saw a bunch in the 90s of people shooting watermelons as a way to advocate for a ban on assault weapons. And if you've ever like dropped a watermelon on the floor and had the thing just completely explode, yeah. Meanwhile, I've fallen and bumped my head. It didn't explode. They're not comparable, but some people have tried to do it because it produces the correct effect.
Well, see. What I thought he was referencing is that a couple of years ago, I believe it was NBC, had a hit piece on the destructive power of the AR-15, and it was supposedly an AR-15 shooting a watermelon, and then it was actually a shotgun, a 12-gauge.
Yeah, a 12-gauge slug going through a watermelon, which just turns it just into vapor.
Right. And I wondered if that's what he was talking about, because as I said, I had a little bit of trouble understanding him. And then he mentioned it once and never again. And it was like, no, wait, go back. What did you mean by that?
Yeah. Also, I've got to say, I was so pleased to see someone who is as highly educated and meticulous as him come through with, like I said, we'd never talked before this, and come through, and he has like so many of my exact debunkings of the Kellerman study that he came out. Now, to be fair, we're probably both referencing the same sources, but it was good to see that the research power that goes into the weird audio fisk had not led me astray.
Well, you're both scientists, so you're very good at research, and you know how to cite your sources. So I'm not surprised.
Yeah, but I mean, also at the same time, I mean, I'm just a marine biologist. I've got a bachelor's degree. This guy's a neurosurgeon, and he's an editor for multiple journals, and his curricula vitae is just amazing. And he wrote an amazing book. Again, I've got a link to it in the show notes, and I'm actually going out on vacation, and I'm bringing it with me. That's going to be my airplane book. It's really good so far.
Yes, but he asked to be on our show. You didn't ask him.
That's correct.
So, Weird Beard, kind of a big deal.
Thank you so much, Aaron. it was good to have him on. He's a really great guy, and I think he will be on at a later show.
So when you have him back, what are you going to talk about?
Actually going to talk about, you mentioned his accent, talking about, he wants to talk about Cuba, and needless to say, his folks had to flee Cuba, and mm-hmm. that might have something to do with why he's so pro-gun.
It might. Gosh.
And by the way, he also said, like, you're going to have to excuse my southern Cuban accent, because, of course, he left Cuba and moved to Georgia after a brief stay in Florida. So he has a thing that most immigrants have, which is people make fun of my funny foreign accent when they talk to me. And then I go to the place where I'm from and talk with other people from that. And they go, boy, you get this weird southern American accent. I've met so many people with that. I had a professor who was German, and he always everyone teases him for him talking like a German, and then he says, then I go home and everyone goes, oh, that American accent, it's so thick.
Well, I had something similar Well, it didn't happen to me, but so I grew up in Europe in the 80s, and my sister is 10 years older than I am. So I've like just started elementary school, more or less, and she goes off to college, and she goes off to college in America because, well, she's tired of being in Europe and wants to go do teenager things. And so she goes to college in Texas because that's where my mom's side of the family is from. And so she comes back for Christmas, and everyone in our family has a little bit of a Southern accent. It's just in the words we use. But she comes back and she's all, "Hey, y'all, Merry Christmas. How you doing?" It's just this thick Southern twang that I still can't replicate. And all of us are just, oh my God. Even my mom, who grew up around it, was just, she thought it was the funniest thing ever. And I mean, at the time, I thought it was just incredibly thick and she was putting us on. And I don't know, maybe she was, but it's entirely possible that just she picked it up from the however many 6-9 months she was there.
It does happen.
Yeah, needless to say, it wore off pretty quickly, and I'm honestly not sure if it was just because she was around us or if it was because we just kept laughing and she had to try and physically reboot and not talk like that.
Well, either way, I definitely have home videos on VHS, kids, ask your folks, of me at my grandmother's house in northern Maine. And I definitely had a few French Canadian affects in my speech just from hanging out with her and talking with her. And you just kind of naturally just start talking like the people you're talking with, especially if you're very familiar and very friendly with them. And so, yeah, it just kind of happens. It wasn't like I was sounding, you know, like Justin Trudeau, not that he has a particularly thick French Canadian accent, but had that whole, you know, it wasn't like it was super thick, but just there were definitely words that sounded like, oh man, you were saying it like that. So it's a human thing. Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcalibers podcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film track, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com, and hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
Wow, you didn't do it again. Huh.
I'm making it a thing.
Well, you can find me at Lurking Rhythmically. That's LURKINGRHYTHMICKALLY. I think. blogspot.com.
Period COM.
Blue Collar Prepping at blogspot.com. PinkPistols.org. And BlazingSword.org.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
He has big names in gun research calling him up and asking for an interview, and I don't. Our popularity is assorted, and so is our podcast. Good night, everybody.
Good night.